From Michigan Radio, this is Living with Cancer. I'm Rebecca Williams. Every year in Holland, Michigan, a group of runners gets together to raise money for the American Cancer Society. The event is called Strides for Life.
I've always had a, I'd like to call it a love-hate relationship with running, but really it was more hate than love. Oh, I'm running 100 miles this year.
100 miles.
100 miles.
100 miles over 4 days.
The first year I ran just to prove I could do it.
I've done this because I lost my mother and two brothers to cancer.
And now it's just something I have to do every year. It's part of me now.
I'm Michelle Wilson, and oh my gosh, 2007 I was diagnosed with cancer. I stopped treatment in 2009, so 2010, 11, and this is 12 I ran, yeah. I guess as far as a reason, the reason is so, hopefully, this won't have to continue forever.
My name is Ron Siegel. I started in 1984, which was the year after my dad passed from cancer. And this is what my way of honoring his memory, and I had always vowed that if I, even if I had to crawl, I would continue to do it. And I'm proving that this year because I am indeed crawling.
A lot of the people we talked with told us they wanted to do something, anything, to end cancer. Cancer galvanizes us. We can't control the disease in our bodies. But outside of that, it's full-on warfare. Survivors battle the cancer within themselves, and scientists fight at the front lines. Others turn to the courts. They think pollution has made them sick, and they think they know who's to blame. But as Sarah Alvarez found out, the courts are not always the best place to turn. Sarah, what's the case you've been following?
Well, there's a group of people in the Midland area suing Dow Chemical. They're suing because Dow contaminated the Tittabawassee River with dioxin, and they live along the river.
What are they concerned about?
They're concerned because the EPA says dioxin is likely to cause cancer. And there were tests coming back showing pretty high levels of dioxin on these properties. So they sued to get something done about it. But the whole thing has been going on for 9 years.
9 years?
9 years. And that's pretty typical for a big environmental case. I spoke to Kathy Henry, and she's one of the plaintiffs in this case. And she is pretty frustrated by the whole thing.
We just wanted the courts to force Dow to basically buy our house so we could leave. And we couldn't really afford to just pack up and leave on our own.
Henry's group has not been successful in getting Dow to pay for any moves or for medical monitoring to look out for future health problems. And let's just say here that these cases aren't easy for the companies being sued either. They take up a lot of time and resources. Sarah Gossman teaches toxic tort classes at the University of Michigan Law School. She says Kathy Henry's experience is not uncommon.
A toxic tort is a lawsuit for personal injury. These cases are complex, they're difficult to prove, they're very expensive.
Let's say, for example, there's a case where people say a company released a chemical into their water, and now some of them have cancer. Sarah Gossman says it's going to get complicated right away.
I think a lot of the difficulty comes from the lack of scientific knowledge about how people get cancer.
And there's one other thing.
Since cancers don't usually show up for 20 to 30 years after the exposure, you have to reconstruct after a great length of time what actually happened. That is the big issue around toxic torts.
Sometimes the system works for plaintiffs. When it does, they can win a lot of money and really change how companies act. But that doesn't happen often. Sarah Gossman says maybe the courts aren't the best place for these kinds of fights, but that people keep ending up there anyway. Why? Because the laws that should protect people from toxic substances in the first place and keep them out of court are weak.
Right now, the federal laws governing these substances, the main federal law governing it, which is called the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA, is widely seen as a failure. It doesn't actually protect people's health.
In fact, that law, it's basically been locked in a drawer. Gossman says the EPA hasn't even tried to use it to regulate any toxic substances at all in more than 20 years. So what are people supposed to do? Well, there are alternatives to the court system, like the 9/11 Health Compensation Act. People who got certain diseases from dust after the Twin Towers collapsed got some money automatically to pay for certain health problems. But that's not happening on a wide scale. So people will still turn to the courts if they think the environment has made them sick. And what advice does Kathy Henry, the woman suing Dow right now, have for those people?
So all you can do is try, but I wish them luck.
So Sarah, we've heard that the courts really didn't work for Kathy Henry, or they haven't yet. But there are big cases where polluters really do get taken to task. I'm sure I'm not the only one who's thinking about Erin Brockovich. Aren't the courts a good place to prove that one chemical or another causes cancer and then to get something done about it?
Sometimes they are. The public can get a lot of information about which chemicals cause disease through the courts. For example, the government was finally able to really prove that smoking causes cancer because they proved it in court. But there's a downside. When the courts are working efficiently, the public is not going to get very much information about chemicals or the diseases they cause from the courts.
Why not?
Well, because when the courts are working efficiently, there's a push to settle. You know, these cases are long. They take up a lot of resources. If a company thinks they're going to lose, so maybe a link is likely to be shown between a chemical they make and a disease, they're going to settle. And when they settle, that settlement might be confidential, meaning we as the public do not have access to that information.
So we're never going to find that out.
Not if the settlement is confidential. And in those cases, even if a plaintiff has hired scientists to demonstrate that a certain chemical causes a certain disease, if the settlement's confidential, the scientific community does not have access to that information, and the public doesn't either.
Okay, so I can see how having a confidential settlement might work for the parties in the case. The plaintiffs get compensated, the defendant can save this, keep this information secure and not have to release it. But what about the rest of us? Don't we have a right to know what chemicals might cause disease?
I think we do. But if we want this information, the courts might not be the best places to settle these types of environmental disputes in the first place.
So is this something that lawmakers are concerned about?
Some of them are. There are these things called Sunshine and Litigation Acts, and that means that a confidential settlement will not be allowed when there is the public health at issue or safety or something else like that. And one of these was introduced last year in the United States Congress, but it didn't really go anywhere. And some states have these laws, too. But Michigan is not one of them.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah.
Sure. Thank you.
There are a lot of things that people with healthy bodies take for granted. Control is one of them. For the most part, we can do what we want. We can go where we want to go. During his treatment for leukemia, Rodney Curtis gave up some of that control.
It's not myine. It must be urine. They monitor my urine here. The total cost of my stay to the insurance company will probably be about $250,000, but to the people that have to dump my collected urine, that cost is far too low. The nurses down here at Carmanis need to know how much my output is keeping pace with my input. So, no toilet for me. It's a series of random jugs, some of them placed bedside in the middle of the night, some elsewhere. I'm the Easter Bunny of pee. The nurses find my hidden treasures, measure them, then dump them. Amazing nurse Melissa was attending to my daily medications and IV drips when she stepped into the bathroom, only to find a few empty jugs. She thought. Has Rodney slowed down his output? And here's what she asked. Did somebody dump urine on you today? I think my response was, oh, I didn't realize we were in one of those relationships, you and I. Is laughter the best medicine? For me, it is. So much of cancer recovery and, indeed, any type of healing is how you look at it. I've been told by doctors, nurses, and former patients that attitude counts for everything when it comes to the difference between success and failure. If attitude is everything, why in the name of everything would I be negative? Oh, I know why. Because it's freaking cancer we're talking about here, and cancer is, by its very definition, negative. You don't hear people talking about a gorgeous sunset or a fantastic meal by saying, "Man, that baked ziti was so creamy and delicious. It's downright cancerous." I've spewed a lot of crazy stuff since I was diagnosed. And if you know me, I was even crazier beforehand. But the one takeaway I've gleaned is to simply push the positive. It's like calisthenics sometimes, making yourself cross over to the sunny side of the street. When the people around me say much of healing is mental, it almost sounds like magical thinking. But I'll try anything. So I force the desperation out of my disposition. But then nighttime shows up. Along with nighttime arrives an insane gut disease, which is so contagious, visitors have to wear paper gowns and rubber gloves when they enter my room. Night also brings Neupogen, shots which explode my bones so the stem cells can settle into my body and bring along their furniture, a couple friends, and even a cardboard box or two of old 8-track tapes they couldn't eBay. And finally, mucositis sneaks on in. It's a mouth and throat disease so painful, it feels like I sleptwalked down to a Rouge River foundry, grabbed a Dixie cup full of molten steel, and swallowed it on a bar bet. Through this all, do I remain positive and upbeat? No, man, heck no. Remember the part about the exploding bones? No, this is beyond pain. But as I reach over and grab the weird device that sucks spit out of my mouth, I realize this too shall pass. It's only for now. And that's the key. It will all be over, eventually. Of that, I am positive.
Rodney Curtis is the author of the book Acute Leukemia. You can read more of his work on his blog, spiritualwanderer.com. We've been hearing from all kinds of people who are living with cancer. It's an experience that takes many forms. It's personal after a diagnosis. There are legal struggles after a pattern of cancer is found, and researchers are still trying to unlock the mysteries of how cancers start. Reporter Mark Brush joins us again. And Mark, you visited some doctors who are trying to figure this out.
Yeah, I stopped by the University of Michigan's Comprehensive Cancer Center. It's one of several dozen cancer research centers around the country. And these centers receive a lot of money from the federal government.
What do they spend it on?
A lot of research. You know, their main purpose is to discover new ways of treating cancer. And they also spend a lot of money and resources on figuring out how to stop cancer in the first place. Researchers have come a long way in understanding cancer cells, but there's still a lot to learn. While I was there at the Cancer Research Center, Dr. Madhuri Kakarala had me peek through her microscope.
Just describe for me what you see here, and I'll tell you what it is.
Okay, let's see here. I see like a cluster of white spots.
Right, that looks kind of like a circular ball, right? A three-dimensional circular ball. That is a mammosphere.
Those are stem cells from human breast tissue. Dr. Kakarala says a chemical many of us are exposed to, bisphenol A, can promote cell growth, and they want to learn if it promotes the growth of some kinds of breast cancers. This is just one experiment in this lab, one puzzle. They're also looking at how some spices, like turmeric and pepper, might keep cells from turning cancerous, and how some foods and anti-inflammatory drugs also might help.
What we are trying to do is look at those individuals that we know have an increased risk of developing cancer, and intervene with those people before they already have cancer.
Much of what they do here falls under the umbrella term of cancer prevention research. Cancer prevention can be cell biology like this, or it can be developing vaccines, or it can mean educating the public about the things that can reduce their cancer risk. Things like maintaining a healthy weight, reducing emotional stress, eating the right foods, and exercising. Some cancer rates are rising, but if you look at all cancers combined, the overall rates have been ticking downward since 2001. More people have quit smoking, and that's led to a drop in lung cancer rates. And more people are getting screened, and that's led to a drop in colon cancer rates. There's a big complex puzzle that still remains, though, and that's, can researchers find the things that increase our cancer risk? There are around 80,000 chemicals all around us in our lives today, and only a fraction of those have been well studied. Many health professionals say that more needs to be done. All this kind of research takes a lot of money. And today, more money is being spent on treating the disease than preventing it. The National Cancer Institute is the biggest funder of research in the U.S. The government agency has an annual budget of more than $5 billion. When we looked at the programs aimed specifically at prevention, we found that only 13% of their 2011 budget went toward this kind of research. When I checked with an NCI official, they said it's actually closer to 27%. Much of the research they fund focuses on basic cell biology, so that can lead to breakthroughs in treatment and prevention, so it's hard to parse out. Dr. Cacarella says no matter what her funding situation, she'll keep looking for answers. In her first year of medical school, she was diagnosed with an advanced thyroid cancer. She says living through that experience helps her when she's in the lab or when she's with her patients.
It makes me really understand the suffering that they're going through because I've been in that bed. And in the lab, it's a huge motivator. You may or may not get your next grant, but I'm not giving up on this because this is a mission. It's not just a career.
Dr. Cacarella says she feels like her experience drives her to solve these complex genetic puzzles, to learn ways to keep our cells from mutating out of control.
Cancer is more than just one disease. There isn't a universal cause, and there probably won't be a universal cure. Each cancer is like a fingerprint. Those differences are linked to our DNA. But it's not just our genes. Everyone's experience with cancer is different. Those differences can be cultural or personal. For Amy Scott and her husband Joe White, cancer was an opportunity.
Cancer was a gift for us. What he was given was the opportunity to fulfill the dreams that everybody talks about.
Karen Hawk says that having cancer changed her in all kinds of unexpected ways.
Having cancer has made me much more empathetic and concerned about others who are ill. Having cancer has made me feel guilty sometimes because I survived. Sometimes having cancer makes me feel, I know I'm stronger because of it.
Everyone's experience with cancer is different. The closer we come to understanding it, the better we can protect ourselves from the things in our environment that can lead to cancer. Living with Cancer was produced by Meg Kramer with assistance from Mercedes Mejia. We had help from Mark Brush and Sarah Alvarez. Tamar Charney was the executive producer. Living with Cancer was informed by the Public Insight Network. I'm Rebecca Williams. This documentary is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan.